Welcome back to Science TLDR, the podcast where we, take these really dense and complex scientific papers and try to distill them down into something, approachable for all of us scientists and experts out there who, maybe don't have time to wade through every single figure and supplementary data table.
It's about getting to the real core of the matter, right? Well, the TLDR, so to speak.
Precisely. And so today we're diving into a pretty provocative paper, I'd say. It was published in PLOS Biology on March 18th, 2025. And the title is pretty striking. The End of the Genetic Paradigm of Cancer.
Okay. The end.
Yeah.
That's quite a statement. So what's the paper all about?
Well, it essentially, it's a direct challenge to the longstanding somatic mutation theory of cancer, or SMT, as you know.
SMT, right.
Yeah. So, SMT, it was really concisely articulated by Stratton and Alexandrov back in 2014. And they said, quote, "All cancers originate from a single cell that starts to behave abnormally due to the acquired somatic mutations in its genome." So essentially, the dogma, right, for decades has been that cancer is fundamentally a genetic disease.
Right.
Arising from these mutations.
It's driven by mutations.
Exactly. Oh. And this is really, this genetic paradigm has driven just an enormous amount of research, especially as we've developed these really powerful genome sequencing technologies.
Oh, absolutely.
And we've cataloged, countless mutations that are associated with various cancers. But as this paper, really astutely points out, these very efforts have also unearthed some significant paradoxes.
Oh, interesting.
Inconsistencies that the SMT, struggles to really reconcile. It's almost as if the deeper we delve into the genome, the more the purely genetic explanation seems kind of incomplete.
Hmm. Okay. So we're seeing cracks in the foundation, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are some of these paradoxes that the paper highlights?
Well, and they're not just, minor discrepancies. I mean, they strike at the heart of the SMT.
Yeah.
So the authors really lay out a pretty compelling array of these paradoxes, urging us to consider, alternative perspectives that are rooted in more of like an organismal biology viewpoint. And so let's maybe start with one that really gets to a fundamental challenge, which is the lack of consistent driver mutations in certain cancers.
Okay.
So they give the example of rhabdomyosarcoma.
Right.
And ependymoma.
Yeah.
These tumors, they consistently present with this cancerous phenotype.
Right.
But they exhibit very few, if any, recurrent genomic mutations. So how does the SMT, with its emphasis on these specific driver mutations initiating the disease?
Right.
How does it account for that?
Yeah, it seems like a big gap, right? If those mutations are supposed to be the drivers,
right,
and yet we're not seeing consistent ones.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So the crucial takeaway here for our listeners is that we're seeing, consistent cancer behavior.
Right.
Without these consistent genetic drivers.
Yeah.
Really questioning the necessity of those drivers.
That's really interesting. So it's like we're seeing the same disease, the same outcome, but the underlying genetic kind of blueprint isn't consistent.
Precisely.
Mm.
Now, another intriguing paradox that they bring up is this issue of indistinguishable mutational signatures. So the paper notes that, the patterns of mutations that we see associated with exposure to known chemical carcinogens.
Right.
They can be virtually identical to the ones that we observe in sporadic cases of the same cancer, where there's no evident exposure to those agents.
Mm. Okay. So you're saying that the mutational pattern itself doesn't necessarily tell you the origin of the cancer.
Exactly. Exactly. And so what implications does this have for the genetic paradigm?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating, right? Because if the mutational fingerprints are the same, regardless of the initiating event,
yeah,
it implies that the mutational process itself might be a consequence of the cancerous state rather than the primary cause, right?
Yeah.
So once a cell or maybe a tissue begins down this malignant trajectory,
yeah,
it might develop this characteristic pattern of genomic instability irrespective of the initial trigger.
Right, right. So almost like, the cellular environment within this this precancerous or cancerous tissue just fosters this particular type of genomic instability.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the tissue is kind of prone to these types of mutations once it's on that path.
Yeah. So the key insight here for our listeners is that, you know, similar mutation patterns don't necessarily point to similar origins.
Right.
And the real challenge is this idea that, you know, specific mutational signatures can reliably identify the initiating carcinogen.
Okay, so we can't just look at the mutations and say, oh, this was caused by smoking or this was caused by, you know, UV radiation.
Exactly. It's more nuanced than that.
That's interesting.
Okay, so moving on. The paper highlights this seemingly ubiquitous association of almost every gene in the genome with cancer.
Oh, wow. Every gene. That sounds like a real signal-to-noise problem if we're trying to figure out what's really driving cancer.
Exactly. But so if nearly every gene has at some point been implicated in cancer, it really diminishes the specificity and the predictive power of any single gene mutation as this definitive driver.
Yeah.
And so this observation really underscores the importance of considering the gene regulatory network.
The GRN, right?
Yeah.
That whole system of genes interacting.
Exactly. Yeah. So the GRN, which is this complex system of interactions between all the genes in a cell.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's likely that the overall activity configuration within this network, which leads to, you know, specific gene expression patterns or transcriptomes, that this is more critical than individual gene mutations in tipping the balance towards malignancy.
Okay. So it's not just about one faulty gene. It's about the whole system being disrupted.
Exactly. It's not just about a single faulty component.
Right.
But potentially this disruption of the intricate network as a whole.
The whole orchestra is out of tune.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So the takeaway here is that this widespread gene association with cancer really suggests that, you know, that system level disruption of gene regulation is more important than isolated gene defects.
Okay. So it's like, you know, thinking about the forest instead of just focusing on individual trees.
Okay.
It's that overall picture that's important.
Exactly. Okay. So now this next paradox is particularly noteworthy, I think. It's the presence of numerous mutations, including those that we classify as oncogenic, you know, cancer causing.
Mm.
But we're finding them in the genomic DNA of perfectly normal tissues.
Wait, so you're saying that healthy tissues have these cancer causing mutations?
Yeah. And these normal tissues can apparently tolerate these mutations without undergoing, you know, any malignant transformation.
Mm.
So this really challenges this idea that these mutations are inherently driving cancer.
Right, because if they were, we'd expect those healthy tissues to become cancerous.
Exactly. And they note that our normal tissues, you know, we accumulate somatic mutations over time just as part of living.
Right.
And this accumulation is even more pronounced in non-cancerous tissues of individuals with inherited cancer syndromes.
Oh, right, because their DNA repair mechanisms might be compromised.
Exactly. So affecting DNA repair. But the fact that these cells don't inevitably become cancerous, it highlights the critical role of context.
Context.
Yeah. So the surrounding tissue microenvironment and the overall cellular state must also be permissive for transformation to actually occur.
So it's not just about the seed, it's about the soil.
Exactly. So the crucial insight here is that oncogenic mutations alone are not enough. You know, the cellular and tissue context act as this powerful suppressor of malignant potential.
So there are other checks and balances in place.
Exactly. Okay, so building on this idea of context, we have this paradox of indolent lesions.
Okay.
So these are pre-malignant conditions.
Right.
Like naive, you know, moles on the skin.
Yeah.
Barrett's esophagus.
Uh-huh.
And ductal carcinoma in situ, or DCIS.
Yeah.
And these lesions, they consistently harbor driver mutations.
Okay.
You know, like in BRAF.
Right.
TP53.
Yeah.
Or PIK3. But yet, only a small fraction of these lesions ever progress to invasive cancer.
Interesting. So they have the genetic hallmarks,
yeah,
but they're not necessarily progressing.
Right. And when they do, the resulting cancers are often clonally unrelated to the initial lesion, which points toward this concept of field cancerization.
Right. So it's not just that one mutated cell that's giving rise to the cancer.
Exactly.
It's a broader change in the tissue.
Yeah. And so what's fascinating here is that these early lesions, despite possessing the genetic hallmarks that supposedly are driving cancer, they frequently remain dormant for extended periods. And then the subsequent emergence of this new genetically distinct cancer within that same tissue field, it suggests that a broader change in the tissue environment, rather than just the clonal evolution of that initially mutated cell, might be the critical event in progression.
Okay, so the whole field is primed for cancer development.
Exactly. Yeah. Field cancerization.
Yeah.
So it implies this regional susceptibility to cancer development.
Okay.
And so the takeaway here is that the presence of driver mutations in premalignant lesions, it doesn't guarantee progression.
Right.
It really suggests that tissue level changes are crucial for the transition to invasive cancer.
So it's like the whole tissue landscape has to shift to allow the full development of cancer.
Yeah. Not just a single cell going rogue.
Yeah. Interesting.
Okay. So let's shift gears a little bit.
All right.
And talk about the impact of ionizing radiation.
Right.
So given its known mutagenic effects.
Right. It causes mutations.
Yeah. You'd expect it to trigger, you know, this pretty straightforward clonal expansion of mutated cells.
Yeah. You'd think so.
Right. But, the paper indicates that multiclonal growth ensues after several cell generations rather than this immediate dominance of a single mutated clone.
Okay.
So how does this fit into the genetic paradigm's focus on single driver mutations?
Well, it challenges the linear clonal selection model, right? That's inherent in SMT.
Yeah.
It seems like ionizing radiation is inducing neoplasia not through the immediate selection of a single advantageous mutation, but rather through maybe cytoplasmic or microenvironmental events,
right?
Like cell stress and tissue injury, which can then lead to genomic instability in multiple cells.
Right. So the environment, again, seems to be a key mediator of the response to this potentially mutagenic insult.
Yeah. So it's not just a direct hit on the DNA.
Right.
It's triggering these broader cellular and tissue responses.
Exactly. So the crucial insight here is that a known mutagen, it doesn't necessarily drive cancer through, you know, this single dominant mutation, but can trigger these broader cellular and tissue responses that promote, you know, this multi-clonal evolution.
Okay, so it's more complex than just a single mutation causing cancer. It's setting off a cascade of events.
Exactly. Okay, so this leads us to this next paradox, which is the apparent lack of consistent positive selection for oncogenic mutations within established tumors.
Okay.
So the SMT, you know, it would predict that cells carrying these driver mutations should, you know, exhibit this clear selective advantage.
Yeah.
They should outcompete their neighbors.
Right.
And eventually dominate the tumor population.
That makes sense, yeah.
But this is often not the case.
Mm.
So we frequently observe significant genetic heterogeneity within tumors, you know, with numerous genetically distinct subclones coexisting.
Yeah, that heterogeneity is well documented.
Right.
Okay.
And while marginal positive selection of some mutated genes, you know, it can occur. It often doesn't manifest as these strong selective sweeps and genetic fixation that, you know, the logic of precision oncology kind of relies upon for effective targeting.
Right. Yeah.
And they note that neutral drift where mutations spread randomly within a population can explain the presence of many non-advantageous mutations.
Okay.
Which could potentially, you know, mimic enrichment.
So it might look like they're being selected for, but they're actually just drifting along.
Exactly. So the takeaway here is that, you know, the lack of this strong positive selection for oncogenic mutations suggests that other factors beyond, you know, just genetic advantage are shaping tumor evolution.
Okay. So it's like trying to target the engine of a car when the problem is actually with the steering.
Right.
We focused on the wrong thing.
Yeah. Speaking of heterogeneity, the paper emphasizes this remarkably complex clonal heterogeneity within tumors, characterized by these branching, parallel, and non-monotonic patterns of subclone kinetics that deviate significantly from a simple linear model of clonal selection.
Right.
So we're seeing, you know, hundreds of genetic clones coexisting, And even, early cancer cell clones can seemingly disappear and then reappear and leukemia relapses.
Oh, wow. So they can go into hiding and come back later.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Right. And that's hardly, straightforward Darwinian competition
Right.
going on there.
Okay.
So this dynamic and often unpredictable behavior of subclones suggests that, factors beyond just intrinsic genetic fitness, such
Yeah.
as, interactions within the tumor microenvironment
Right.
and stochastic events.
Random chance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Significantly influence the fate of cancer cell populations.
Yeah.
And this hiding and reappearance of clones, especially in relapses, points to mechanisms of dormancy
Right.
and reactivation that are not solely determined by the genetic makeup of the cells.
Right.
So the crucial insight here is that the complex dynamics of tumor subclones, they challenge the SMT's linear progression model,
Yeah.
and they highlight the importance of non-genetic factors
Yeah.
in shaping tumor evolution.
Okay, so we need to look beyond just the genes themselves.
Exactly. And then adding another layer of complexity is this observation of stochastic clonal kinetics in recurrence. So, relapsing tumors frequently show no direct lineage relationship to the primary tumor.
Oh, interesting. So
Correct.
it's not necessarily a direct descendant of the original tumor.
Exactly. Which challenges this idea of genetic bottlenecks as this consistent signature of stepwise clonal selection.
Right.
It's almost as if the recurrence arises de novo,
Oh. So the cancer is almost reinventing itself.
Right. However, they do note that some recurrent genetic alterations can arise rapidly and independently in early stage cells, which is consistent with, this idea of punctuated equilibrium.
Okay, so there are some patterns that we do see,
Yeah.
but it's not always a straight line from the primary tumor to the recurrence.
Right. So it suggests that while the overall clonal evolution might appear stochastic,
Yeah.
certain genetic pathways might be more susceptible to alteration under specific selective pressures or within particular tissue environments,
Okay, that makes sense.
leading to these recurrent but independent events.
Yeah.
So it's a more nuanced picture than, this simple linear progression dictated by initial driver mutations.
Right.
And so the takeaway here is that, the unpredictable genetic origins of recurrence really challenge this SMT model of linear clonal evolution from a primary tumor.
Okay, so we need to be more open to different possibilities, different trajectories.
Exactly. Okay. And then we delve into the realm of non-genetic phenotypic heterogeneity.
Okay, non-genetic, so this is beyond the genes.
Right. So even within clonal cell populations, cells with identical genome,
Right.
single-cell transcriptomics is revealing this surprising degree of variability in their gene expression patterns.
Interesting.
Right. And this is known as phenotypic plasticity.
Okay, so they have the same DNA, but they're expressing their genes differently.
Exactly. And we're observing, mutated cells with transcriptomes that are indistinguishable from non-mutated cells.
Wow.
Cells transitioning between different transcriptional states,
Okay.
and progenitor cells carrying oncogenic mutations, still differentiating into various lineages.
So even though they have the mutations, they're still behaving like normal cells in some ways.
Right,
Yeah.
right. It's as if the same genetic code can produce this range of cellular identities.
Yeah. So the genotype doesn't necessarily determine the phenotype. There's
Exactly.
more to it than that.
Right. And this really underscores a critical disconnect between genotype and phenotype.
Yeah.
So while the genome provides the blueprint,
Yeah.
the actual state of the cell, its transcriptome and
Yeah.
its behavior is also heavily influenced by epigenetic
Yeah,
factors
right.
and the microenvironment.
Okay.
So this non-genetic heterogeneity can have, significant functional consequences,
Right.
leading to diverse responses to growth signals, therapeutic agents,
Yeah.
and even varying susceptibilities to further genetic insults.
Wow, that's really important. So
Right.
even if two cells have the same mutation, they might respond differently to treatment.
Exactly. So the crucial insight here is that identical genetic backgrounds can give rise to diverse phenotypes,
Right.
really highlighting the limitations of predicting cellular behavior solely from genotype.
Okay, so we can't just rely on the genetic information alone.
Right, exactly. And this brings us to this concept of alternative isogenic cell states. So these, persister cells that can confer treatment tolerance without any underlying genetic alterations.
So they're resistant to treatment, but they haven't acquired any new mutations.
Right.
Interesting.
And these states are reversible,
Okay.
yet they can serve as a substrate for Darwinian selection, even in the absence of new mutations. So this is a significant departure from the traditional SMT emphasis on genetic mutations driving resistance. So these persister states, they represent a form of phenotypic switching, where cells can, transiently adopt this drug-resistant state as a survival mechanism.
Makes sense.
And because these changes are non-genetic, they can be reversed,
Okay.
which has, profound implications for therapeutic strategies.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it also demonstrates that Darwinian selection can operate on pre-existing phenotypic variation
Right.
within a clonal population
Yeah.
without requiring the emergence of new genetic mutations.
So it's selection acting on traits that are already there, but maybe hidden.
Right, exactly. So the key takeaway here is that non-genetic reversible cell states, they can drive treatment resistance, and they serve as a substrate for selection, which really challenges this SMT focus on genetic mutations as the primary source of resistance.
So we might be looking in the wrong place for the source of that resistance.
Exactly. And then perhaps most strikingly, the paper discusses how therapy resistance, including these persister states, can be induced by the treatment itself,
Oh, wow.
rather than simply being selected for from this pre-existing population of resistant mutants.
So the treatment is actually creating the resistance.
Right. And this suggests this almost Lamarckian-like dynamic where the environment, in this case, the therapy, is directly influencing the characteristics of the cells. And they note that stem-like treatment-resistant cells can arise as this active, regulated cellular response to stress, mediated by specific signaling pathways.
So it's not just passive selection, it's an active response.
Exactly. And so this therapy-induced resistance poses a major challenge in cancer treatment.
Right, because you're fighting against the treatment itself.
Exactly. And the fact that resistance can arise as this direct response to the therapy rather than solely through the selection of pre-existing genetic mutants suggests that we need to, consider how our interventions are shaping the cellular landscape and potentially inducing these resistant states. It also points towards the importance of, targeting these inducible resistance mechanisms. So the crucial insight here is that therapy itself can induce resistance, suggesting that these Lamarckian-like mechanisms play a role in treatment failure.
Okay, so that's a lot to unpack. I mean, these are really compelling paradoxes. And collectively, I think they present a pretty significant challenge to the sufficiency of the genetic paradigm as the sole framework for understanding cancer.
Absolutely.
So where do we go from here? I mean, based on these findings, what would you say are the three major takeaways for our audience?
Yeah, that's a great question. So firstly, I think the sheer weight of evidence presented by these paradoxes, the lack of consistent driver mutations, the presence of oncogenic mutations in normal tissue, the nonlinear clonal evolution, it strongly suggests that the somatic mutation theory, while, it's been historically valuable, it provides an incomplete picture of tumorigenesis.
Okay, so SMT is not wrong, but it's not the whole story.
Right, exactly. It needs an update. Secondly, the paper really compellingly highlights the critical role of non-genetic factors in cancer. So cell state dynamics, which are governed by gene regulatory networks and influenced by the epigenetic landscape, along with the crucial influence of tissue organization and the tumor microenvironment, they offer these powerful alternative frameworks for understanding the initiation, the progression, and the treatment resistance of cancer. And these perspectives, they underscore the importance of cellular plasticity and context-dependent
Okay,
behavior.
so it's not just about the genes, it's about how the cells are interacting with their environment
Exactly.
and how they're able to change and adapt.
Right. And then thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, for future research directions, this work emphasizes the imperative for a paradigm shift in how we approach cancer research. So moving beyond, you know, this strictly gene-centric view towards this more integrated systems-level understanding that incorporates principles from developmental biology, physiology, and evolutionary biology.
Okay, so we need to be more holistic in our approach.
Exactly, exactly. And this broader perspective may reveal, you know, novel therapeutic vulnerabilities.
Right.
Related to cell state stability and tissue homeostasis that are currently being overlooked in our relentless pursuit of specific driver mutations.
So there might be other ways to target cancer that we're not even considering right now.
Exactly.
Because we're so focused on the genes.
Right, right.
That's really thought-provoking.
Yeah, it definitely provides us with much to consider. So thank you for this insightful deep dive into this thought-provoking paper. It certainly encourages a critical reevaluation of the prevailing paradigm in cancer research.
My pleasure. It's been a great discussion.
Yeah, I agree.
I think this paper is really going to shake things up.
I think so too.
And hopefully lead to some really exciting new avenues of research.
Absolutely. Well, to our listeners out there, you know, keep those brains buzzing.
Yeah.
And until next time, keep exploring the fascinating world of science.
Keep questioning, keep exploring.